Okay, well, I'll go ahead and get started. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on which time zone you're joining us from. And thank you for tuning in to the Fulbright Arctic Initiative webinar. My name is Susan Rindall. I'm the Assistant Director for Fulbright Student and Scholar Multi-Regional Programs at IIE. And I'm joined today by several of our partners and sponsors of the program, which I'm very glad to have them on the session today. And first and foremost is Steve Money, who is the Deputy Director and sponsor at the U.S. Department of State. Thank you for being here with us. Steve, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Susan. Hi, everyone, and welcome. We're so glad you could join us for this informational webinar for potential applicants for the Fulbright Arctic Initiative Round 3. As Susan said, my name is Steve Money. I work at the U.S. Department of State in the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, where I'm the Deputy Director of the Global Fulbright Program, which is the U.S. government's flagship international educational exchange program. Over its nearly 75-year history, the Fulbright Program has built an outstanding record of academic achievement and international collaboration, providing opportunities to more than 390,000 programs from 160 countries to study, teach, conduct research, exchange ideas, and contribute to finding solutions to pressing global issues. The Fulbright Program is one of the State Department's oldest and most important people-to-people exchange programs, and it supports study, research, and teaching for over 8,000 participants every year. The program is supported financially by the U.S. government and also partner governments around the world, including our very important partners in the Arctic. And we're glad that representatives from Fulbright commissions and offices in several of the Arctic countries are here with us on this webinar today. The funding partnerships that the State Department has with partner governments as well as the private sector truly makes Fulbright a global program, and that makes it a wonderful forum to bring together the best minds to study our shared challenges in the Arctic region and find practical solutions. The Fulbright program is always striving to be dynamic and relevant to the lives of individuals, communities, and countries, and to respond to global challenges such as the real and immediate changes happening in the Arctic and the impacts of those changes on people, the environment, communities, and economies. It was really that need that we identified that prompted us to establish the Fulbright Arctic Initiative back in 2015 during the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council. And it led us to renew it again in 2018 and again now in 2020 to support a third cohort of Fulbright Arctic scholars. This is really kind of a unique Fulbright program in that it really is about convening a group of top minds and researchers and scientists and scholars from throughout the eight Arctic countries to allow them to break out of the traditional boundaries of their scientific disciplines or their country research systems or their home universities and collaborate with each other to present new and innovative solutions to key international policy questions. And if we go to the next slide, Chanel, this really is a different model for Fulbright, which for 75 years has really been based on giving grants to talented students and academics for individual projects. But this, as I said, is much more of a collaborative group effort. If you go to the next slide, Chanel, this slide shows just how this model works. You know, it's multilateral in that it involves people from all eight Arctic nations. It's multidisciplinary, it's interactive, it's applied, it's relevant to policymakers at the national and international and local levels. It involves the participation of Arctic communities, and a large component is public outreach and public communication. So we think this model is really suited to research in the Arctic. And we're really pleased this time around for the third round of the Arctic Initiative to have two new lead scholars providing intellectual leadership throughout the program. And they're with us on this webinar today. They are Dr. Greg Peltzer, a professor in the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada, and Dr. Elizabeth Rink, a professor of community health at Montana State University. Both Dr. Peltzer and Dr. Rink are alumni of earlier rounds of the Arctic Initiative, so they know exactly what this program is about, how it works, and what it's like for a participant. And I'm really happy to introduce the two of them to talk a little bit more about the program, about the themes for round three, and about how they anticipate this diverse and talented group of academics and scholars will work together over the coming years. So I will turn it over to Greg and Beth.
Okay, well, hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Rink. I go by Beth, so everybody please call me Beth. And I think, Greg, maybe I'll talk about the program and my experience and the themes, and then you can fill in. Does that sound good?
That's perfect.
Okay. So I was a scholar in the second round of the Fulbright Arctic Initiative, and my research in the Arctic has primarily been, or only has been, in Greenland for the past 14 years, and I study sexual and reproductive health, and as we would say in North America, I look at the social determinants of sexual and reproductive health in Indigenous communities in Greenland, and my methodology is always mixed methods and within a community-based participatory research framework. And I was motivated to participate or apply for the Fulbright Arctic Initiative specifically because all of my research, like I had said, has been in Greenland, and I did not have experience in other Arctic communities. So for my Fulbright program and my participation in Fulbright, I went to Finland and did my field work and independent research project with the Fulbright Arctic Initiative in northern Finland in Utsjoki with Sami people there. And I can say that experience was amazing, and it definitely opened up my eyes to just my area of expertise and how different Indigenous communities across the Arctic look at reproductive health. But more importantly than my individual project was the group experience and working with my group in the Resilience Communities group, and then also having a lot of interaction with the other group, which was the Sustainable Economies group, which I hope Laura from Iceland will be able to talk about her experience in that group with us. So it really was the interdisciplinary work that we did in our groups with the scholars from all of the Arctic nations that was amazing, and it really opened my eyes to how important it is to collaborate from different areas of expertise to really address the challenges in the Arctic. So I encourage the applicants to really think about the different themes that Greg and I will talk about here in a minute, and how your area of expertise applies to the interdisciplinary work of the different areas, the different theme areas for this third cohort. So I think I'll stop there maybe. Greg, do you want to talk a bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, just very briefly, I've been, working on Northern and Arctic issues for roughly 30 years now. And I've had some tremendous experiences, as I'm sure many of the people on the webinar have also had. Most of my work in my early years was northern Canada and Russia, especially eastern Siberia, where I did quite a few field seasons. And as dean of undergraduate studies for the University of the Arctic, this is back 2003 to 2008, that was my first major collaborative work, leading a team of scholars, Indigenous authors, practitioners across the eight Arctic states in terms of curriculum development. And that's gotten now, I think, about 15,000 student enrollments over the years now. But it showed the power of what we can do collectively and why this particular initiative, the Fulbright Arctic Initiative, which is multidisciplinary, multinational, and multi-level, frankly, is simply amazing. These are one of these once-in-a-lifetime experiences. And one of the things that you'll see this, and it's one I never get tired of repeating, is that a Fulbright claims that these, sometimes a Fulbright scholarship can be career-changing for many individuals and even life-changing. And I'll tell you this, I always say, I went in saying, okay, that's the sales hype around the program. What I didn't expect is that it was actually true. And it was simply amazing. In terms of the professional linkages, networks, access to policymakers, this particular program has, and I'll tell you, it's the people like the Steves here in the United States, and the Michael Haas in Canada, and Terry's in Finland, and so on and so forth. Is this makes all the difference. The support networks you have from Iceland to Finland, Norway, Canada, Russia is just, and the United States, of course, phenomenal. And it's life-changing. It certainly is. To truth be told, I wouldn't have a house full of solar panels and electric vehicle if it hadn't been the Fulbright. And what the experiences that it opens up and the opportunities, and to actually make not just impact factor with your scholarship, but real impact in communities and policies, makes this particular program truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So for those of you who apply and are successful in through the process, seize every moment like it was your last, because this is just a phenomenal experience. All right.
So this is Beth again. The program is 18 months, and the deadline, I think, for most of the countries, or at least in the U.S., is September 15th. And we'll start the program in spring of 2021, but the applicants that have been selected to be scholars in the third cohort will notify you. I think the plan is by December. And there will be three in-person meetings that we're planning right now. And the first one will be sometime in the later spring, maybe end of March in Canada. But we'll, once the scholars have been selected, that process, everybody will know what's going on. You're also expected to have an individual Fulbright exchange that is, I think it's, what does it say here, 1.5 to 3 months. And that needs to be consecutive, so you can't just go to your site for a week and then go back to your home country and go back and forth. You have to, for your first time in the at your field site, you have to be there consecutively. So that's important to understand for those of you that are navigating relationships and family and other work commitments. In between the three in-person meetings and also during your individual research exchange, we'll have ongoing virtual meetings, and we can also coordinate with you in-person collaborations. So Greg and I will be working with Steve and Susan and the other Fulbright commissions to coordinate those virtual meetings. And each meeting will have a different topic that will be based on the needs of the cohort. And you will be expected to participate in those. They're usually only about an hour. And we have them like once a month for an hour on a set day. And then in both cohort one that Greg was in, and then in our cohort two that Lara from Iceland and I were in, we also organized in-person meetings within our groups. That is really up to the groups to decide how they want to do those, where they want to do those, and when they want to do those. We have three research themes for this third cohort. The first is Arctic security and cooperation. The second one is Arctic infrastructure in a changing environment. And then the third one is community dimensions of health. And maybe, Greg, could you speak to those?
Sure. Yeah. You bet. And I'll just jump one point back, the point you mentioned, Beth, about spending 6 weeks to 3 months on site at your host institution and place. Why that's so deadly important, it's not only in terms of the research and building research network and actually doing the field work that you'd be doing at the place of your location, but it's also the cultural dimension is really difficult to overstate. And I'll tell you this, the connections that you make, that I made with local people, with journalists, which are a great source of information in how things are working on the policy front and so on, you simply can't get that unless you're there where you're available to go for a coffee with a local newspaper reporter that can fill you in, or an archivist, or somebody from an Indigenous regional corporation or what have you. And you got to be on the ground for that. But to me, honestly, that was the biggest surprise as well, being this is not your typical research exchange program. That cultural dimension is just going to deepen your ability as a scholar and levels you won't anticipate. I just want to make that point. When we flip over to the three themes, so yeah, this year's themes were, as Beth mentioned them, so the Arctic security and cooperation, and the world changes and things move forward and evolve, and the Arctic security and cooperation focuses on a broad range of Arctic security issues. That's inclusive of, you know, geopolitical realities and traditional security issues, but it also includes, very importantly, human security, environmental security, economic security, energy security, and the means and ways in which we see these kind of cooperations among the Arctic states, but also, as everyone has seen over the last decade or so, an increasing interest from the EU, from countries in Asia, particularly China, Korea, Japan, India, even Singapore has a huge interest in things Arctic. So that one is tying those kind of things. Where does the Arctic sit around these different security dimensions? Arctic infrastructure in a changing environment, no surprise, we're experiencing some significant environmental changes globally. And that has a huge impact on infrastructure. And that includes everything from water to energy, in particular, transportation, housing stock. And that, I'm going to let Beth talk to the community dimensions, but to keep in mind across all three of these thematic areas, there's obvious intersection. And I know for some of you, when both Beth and I either together or individually have talked to prospective scholars, one of the things that people have a difficulty figuring out is, in some cases, which of these themes fit. And if you have difficulty thinking that you could fit in one, two, or possibly even three, well, then you found the right program, because we see these linkages across these as extremely important. They're not siloed. They're meant to be ones where there's important reinforcing and consequential linkages. Beth, did you want to talk to community health? And maybe we'll let the expert talk about that one.
Yeah, so this year, or for this cohort three of Fulbright Arctic Initiative, our health focus, the community dimensions of health group, is really taking a a more collective, holistic look at health. And so we're really focused on those community systems, structural determinants of health in the Arctic. And we have on the Fulbright Arctic Initiative website, you know, examples of questions that were, you know, a scholar in the community dimensions of health or even the other two groups can look at. But really we're looking, as Greg said, to look at those intersections between the natural and built environment and health. We're obviously very interested in how pandemics on a global level impact community levels of health in the Arctic, and what are some of the barriers and facilitators to addressing pandemics in the Arctic from a community, through a community lens. We're also looking at how can interventions, multi-level interventions that address security, the environment, as well as health, impact communities. So for those of you that are interested in the community dimensions of health group, it's important to think beyond those individual level factors that sometimes we tend to in public health research to focus on. I also want to point out too that we're also very interested in the arts and how different art forums and different art mediums can communicate information not only about health but the other two groups as well. So we're also just very interested in that artist, like how through an artistic lens you might want to communicate and address some of the issues that are going on in the Arctic. And I want to build on what Greg has said about the interdisciplinary nature of the three groups. It's going to be very important in your applications to identify a primary group that you believe your area of expertise fits with, but then we also want you to identify another group, at least one, where you also could possibly fit into, and that's just because we really want to emphasize the interdisciplinary and the cross-disciplinary work of the different groups. And as Greg said, he and I have gotten lots of questions and lots of emails, and we've met with several interested applicants as well. And what we found is that people are very focused on the individual field exchange, and that for sure is important because it is, you know, one of the hallmarks of Fulbright is this individual exchange, cultural knowledge, education exchange. And so that definitely is important. We also want to highlight that the group work is also incredibly important. So please make sure in your applications that you address that. And I just want to give an example, like when I applied for to be in the second cohort, I didn't have any experience with sustainable economies, which was the other group that was in the second cohort. And so I made the case that, yes, of course, I don't have any experience in sustainable economies, but I know my methodology, and I know my mixed methods, and I know how to work with communities, and I know community engagement. So I can partner with a microbiologist who maybe only has lab experience, or an economist that only, you know, works with numbers and spreadsheets. I can partner with a scholar from a totally different background because of my methodology. So that's just one example of how you might think through your area of expertise and your connection to another group.
Good. Now we're at alumni stories, I think.
Laura?
Great, yes. We have Lara Johannesdottir from Iceland, who was a scholar from the Fulbright Arctic Initiative Round 2. And Greg and Beth, I hope all three of you could share your personal experiences with the fellowship.
You betcha. Lara, you go first. There she is.
Lara, we're having trouble hearing you.
Well, one of us could jump in while we're...
Greg, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, sure. You bet. So when I applied, it was it's interesting because it changed. So obviously, as a Canadian scholar, I was looking for a place in the United States. In one area is interesting of all the work I've done across the circumpolar north, in especially Scandinavia and Russia, I'd spent very little time in Alaska. And for me, that's why I ended up choosing Alaska, working both at the ICER, the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage, which were phenomenal hosts, and also with colleagues at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I originally wanted to look at a question about extracting the maximizing social benefit for communities around the extractive resource sector, whether it's oil or mining, and learning the lessons in Alaska that might be useful for back in Canada. But what ended up happening was the group project, I was in the energy group, ended up focusing on renewable energy. So my own individual work was kind of a hybrid of looking at these kind of sustainability practices, including the Alaska Fund and their sovereign wealth fund and some of those practices, but evolved to focus a lot on the renewable energy sector, which I wasn't anticipating. And since then, as a consequence of that, we've actually were successful in it's about a $9 million research project coming after Fulbright, but because of Fulbright, with networks with colleagues from Sweden, Finland, Norway, and the United States, particularly Alaska, and both institutions, the University of Alaska Anchorage and University of Alaska Fairbanks. And so that experience was, as I said, it was life-changing personally, but also scholarly-wise. And now we have a major international project that spans 17 communities across 5 countries. 4 countries where the community research is occurring, and so that was my experience in a nutshell. I always talk about the group work because you're working with colleagues that you've never worked with before, probably never heard of before, because coming from different disciplines. And I always say it's kind of like an arranged marriage, but it's amazing when you get to your new colleagues and partners and negotiating and working out what you're going to do together. But something magical happens in that process, because anyone who applies and is successful in this program is in it for both reasons, you know, impact factor, but impact. And it's a different breed of scholars and practitioners that want to work in this space and typically already are. So it is fun. At times challenging, but always rewarding. And you grow as a scholar in a way that I never anticipated, even at that time, a mid-career scholar, that the growth was just phenomenal. So that was my experience in a nutshell.
Do you hear me now?
Yes, Laura.
Yeah. Okay, great. Should I go next?
You bet.
Okay, thanks. Nice to meet you all. So I was in the second cohort, and I was in the Sustainable Economies Group. And this was, as you said, Greg, this was once in a lifetime experience, not just for me personally, but also for my family. Because doing my exchange in the United States, this became a family experience for us. So we moved to the U.S. for 2 months, and I had have a teenager, and he went to high school in the U.S. So this was not just an experience for me, but also for my family. And also throughout this program, someone said to me that this experience is like you feel that like you are an academic rock star. And this was my experience. But also, this was a bit of a struggle, for instance, in my group to figure out how can we work together. We came from very different type of different background. So we had to think about what is the common theme that we can work on. And in the end, we figured out that we could all of our projects, different type of projects from different disciplines, we had all element of risks in our previous work or current work. So we actually made a framework on how to assess the risk in the Arctic and where we could look at different economies in the Arctic, like the subsistence economies, the mixed economies, the market economies, and reaching from local scales to global scales and within the context of institutional context and the social and cultural and environmental context. So we published together a paper on that one. I think that one is a really good paper and it can be useful for instance, for the next cohort. And as an individual assignment, I have a previous background, a practical background from the insurance sector, but I also am now a full professor at the University of Iceland. But coming from the finance sector, from insurance, I wanted to explore the role of insurance in the Arctic and the risks. And that made me think about what can I do. And I decided to focus on systemic risk. And systemic risk is very interesting because then we are thinking about very different scales than usually is done when we are thinking about the risks. And I have published a paper on the paper is on systemic risk of marine-related oil spills. But today we can also think about systemic risk in relation to the COVID-19, the pandemics. So actually, I gained a lot in terms of just new way of thinking by exploring both my the topic in my individual assignment, but also in the group assignment. I have been reaching out to my cohort. Like I'm currently writing a book on corporate social responsibility in the Arctic, and I have reached out to my previous scholars to figure out can they identify some cases that I can explore in the book and so forth. So this is currently a relevant for me, and I'm very thankful for having taken part in this project.
Thanks, Laura and Greg. So this is Beth again. So I am going on 15 years of working in Greenland, and also I work with tribal communities here in Montana, where I'm based. And I have very long-standing relationships with people in Greenland and also here in Montana. And I, over time, after obviously working almost 15 years with groups of people, like you get to know them and there's a familiarity there. So when I went to Finland for my exchange and I went up to Utsjoki and I knew nobody and nobody knew me, I would say that like my most profound experience in my individual exchange was just that humility that is so important to maintain no matter where you are in your career. It was like I had to start all over again. I wanted at the time, I was like, oh, Beth, you should have known better. you should have known that this would happen. But it really took, it was very profound in that way to humble me and to understand that just how important it is to stay humble throughout your career when you're going into a new community and you're working with people, especially like with me, my topic on sexual and reproductive health is very sensitive. And so my, you know, my meetings and my interviews with people were just very thoughtful and very different than anything I had experienced before, which was an amazing learning experience. I was, you know, after people understood why I was up in Utsioki, I was, you know, invited into people's homes, and I participated in the culling of the reindeer because I was up there during the fall. So I would say that it like by the time I had to leave Utsioki, I didn't want to leave because it was so just deeply personal, and people really took me in and really started to you know, talk to me openly about, you know, their lives and anything related to reproductive health. It also was very, just from a scholarship point of view, Finland and with the Sami, the way that they address sexual and reproductive health is just very different than in Greenland or here in the United States with our tribal communities. So from an intellectual scholarship point of view, it was very intellectually challenging to wrap my mind around, well, how, you know, how has what I've learned in Finland, how can that be applicable to improving sexual and reproductive health disparities in Greenland and then also in other parts of the Arctic. And I would say with, you know, similar to maybe what Lara and Greg have said, that really the group experience was truly amazing. And our group chose to do a retreat right before our second in-person meeting. And we spent 3 days in a cabin in Finland working on manuscripts and potential future grant proposals. And that was probably like the really most powerful moment, I would say, in the Fulbright experience that I had, was just being 3 days with a group of people that you kind of know them by now, but not really. And then you're like living together and working together. And our group has gone on, we've published one paper so far. We have about 3 or 4 that are in review. Maybe even more than that, it could be even 5. We have 2 proposals that one is in review, another one is that we're working on right now. So just to reiterate what Greg said, the relationships that you make in your group really are life-changing, and definitely professionally they're relationships that you'll keep moving forward. And then the other powerful moment maybe for me in my with the whole cohort, like Laura's group in sustainable economies and our group, was really also during the last meeting where we go to Washington, D.C. and we present our policy recommendations that we've worked on as groups throughout the 18 months. And it was really at that meeting that it was almost like, oh, okay, now we're ready for both groups to work together even more closely. And I think that's why Greg and I were so, why it was so important for Greg and I to really emphasize the cross-group work in this third cohort. Because, you know, after 18 months of working together and watching what's going on in each group, you really start to see the synergy that can take place across the groups. And so that, I would say, for our second cohort happened in Washington, D.C. when we were at the Wilson Center and giving lots of talks on our policy recommendations for the Arctic.
Yeah, I'm just wondering before we jump to the next pieces on the slide, whether we might answer verbally some of the questions that have popped up in the chat, because they're pretty on topic with some of the stuff we just discussed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so there is a question here for Beth. How did you use interpreters in your work, and how did you gain permission within your community for human subject work?
So speaking as a researcher, I would say a limitation of my research was that in northern Finland was that I only spoke with women that knew English. My interviews were conducted in English. They weren't conducted in Sami or in Finnish. And then as far as the ethical approval, I got ethical approval from University of Oulu, which was my home institute. And then also from Montana State University, where I'm based. So I got two ethical approvals, and I had consent forms for my interviews, and in some instances the women were okay with me tape recording, and in others they weren't, which is normal when you're doing in-depth personal interviews. So that's how I navigated that. There was also a question about from Stephen. Hi, he says, hi, I see additional application questions. Scholars will be expected to produce a policy brief based on their group work and one research product of the group's choosing, and then three, a one-page description of their individual research project objectives, outcomes, and exchange experiences. Can you please explain further what you are looking for, especially for me as a fine art photographer? So to answer a policy brief based on your group work. So once you are, once the scholars are put into one of the three groups, during that first meeting in Canada that we will have in spring of 2021, you will start talking and brainstorming and discussing, based on your respective areas of expertise, what is the pressing policy issue in the Arctic related to your group topic. So at the end of your 18 months, you'll be expected to, as a group, produce policy recommendations based on based on what your group perceives are the pressing policy issues related to, community dimensions of health or Arctic security and cooperation. So you can go on the Fulbright Arctic Initiative website and see the examples from Cohort 1 and Cohort 2 of our policy briefs. But, we can't say what that actually is going to contain, because that the content of those policy briefs, because that is up to your group. And then as far as the second requirement, the group needs to produce one product, is as Lara mentioned and Greg and I all mentioned, our group all landed on publishing manuscripts together. Greg's group has gone on to, to do big projects and have and my group's going on to proposals and projects as well. But for your 18 months, your group will have to decide on at least one product. So that could be an article. It could be maybe it could be a visual arts project based on, Stephen, your area of expertise, but then visually portraying whatever your group topic is. So it really will depend on the group. So again, all of that gets decided by the group. And then the last piece there is that for this third cohort, we want each of the scholars to produce a one-page document about their individual field exchange. So, you know, what were the outcomes? What did they study? What did they learn? And so that we can start posting those on the Fulbright Arctic Initiative webpage to just start to give future cohorts an understanding of what people did.
Yeah, and you know, me add to that about especially when if you're in the fine arts world, whether a photographer or a visual artist working with other media. In our group, we had a visual artist, Diddy Hitchings, and did phenomenal work on, especially in, she was in the water group and looking at issues around, especially icebergs and so on. The work she did a number of pieces, and those were displayed, of course, in Washington, D.C., but did a phenomenal a job of that. And so you can see somebody who is either a fine art photographer or somebody who works in documentaries, which I know is different, and so on, capturing the stories and that storytelling and that visual representation is so deadly important in the power that we saw in the first cohort. So I would write it from when you're thinking about how to frame it in terms of your project objectives, don't think of it so much, especially depending on which discipline you come from, you know, a conventional, you know, the scientific objectives, et cetera, and your methods, et cetera. Do what's appropriate from your disciplinary perspective, because that's going to shine through the strongest. But I'll tell you, that is an area that would be very warmly welcomed. I saw a question earlier about how do you choose which of the three themes. I think Susie Crate may have had that out there. Yeah, and it's, when you see linkages, how do we choose one? It's, what I suggest to people is take three pieces of paper called 1, 2, and 3, put it in a bag, swirl it around, and pull out, and whatever number it is, that's the one to go with. But seriously, don't worry too much. Make the one in your application that you think is makes a compelling case. And here's the reality. Certainly in our group, what people thought was their first choice, once the committee goes to assemble the groups, you might not even end up in the one that you thought was your number one theme versus your number two. And that's just the nature of the beast. But what we're more interested in looking for, don't worry, there's not a right or wrong answer often to these things. Like, how do you choose between human security and community health or environmental security and infrastructure? Those aren't always obvious answers. But the fact that you see the linkages among two or three groups, much more important. So what I encourage people, do not get hung up on choosing 1, 2, or 3, but what do you think makes the most compelling case? That there's no right or wrong answer to that.
Thanks, Greg. I'm also seeing some questions, and I know Greg and I have gotten these questions too before today, about like, do you need a letter of invitation, and how do you select where you're going to go? And Susan has answered this. You don't necessarily need a letter of invitation at the time you apply. You do need to state where you would want to go and what you want to do and why. So that then Greg and I and Steve and Susan and the other Fulbright commissions can help place a scholar in the appropriate place. I also just want to say that I know I've gotten a lot of questions about coming to the United States because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and I just want to reiterate that you have, that the, all the scholars that are, come to the United States have from spring of 2021 to fall of 2022 to do their field exchange. So hopefully within that time frame, the pandemic will be more under control. So I want to just reiterate that, because I know people are concerned, because some people like Laura, like, you know, how she talked about, she brought her family here, and other scholars from both groups brought their families to the United States. So you do have that whole 18 months to decide where you want to go. And then the other point I want to make is that for the scholars coming to the United States, you can go anywhere in the United States. I think sometimes we've gotten emails about people thinking, well, they need to go to Alaska because Alaska is in the Arctic. And certainly if it makes sense for your research area and what you want to learn and what you need to get out of your individual field exchange, if Alaska makes sense, that's great. But you can go anywhere. We had people go to New Hampshire, to Dartmouth in my cohort. We had a scholar from Russia go to a university in Maine. You can go anywhere in the United States to learn what you need to learn in order to support your area of expertise in the Arctic. And the U.S. is a very big place, like you all know. So I just, again, like I encourage you to think big, like what Greg has said. Like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to work individually in maybe a new place as well as work in a group.
That's a really good point, Beth. And I want to tie this into a question from Devorah from Nunavut. Do you have to do your field research in that other country? And if it's from Canada, it'd be presumably the United States. Or can you do your field work like in Nunavut? And so when you're thinking about where you're going to go for your host institution, think about it in terms of what's going to be a maximum benefit. Say if you're from Nunavut, Northwest Territories, Northern Saskatchewan, wherever, or other places in the Arctic, what that can bring back. So no, you don't have to do field work per se at that host institution. So I'll tell you, in our, if Maine sounds exotic, we had one Canadian scholar did his host visit at the University of Hawaii. Which is strange. I couldn't never understand why a Canadian in the middle of winter would want to go to Hawaii. But that's where he went and did his field work. But a place like even Hawaii, which you would not normally think any connection to the Arctic, has world-class research on water, which he was looking at, and impacts in his field work that he does, and his lifeline is doing work up in the Northwest Territories. And so you learn valuable things there. Hawaii also has a lot on energy, especially because there's no grids, of course, being islanded. So we have people at Duke, people at California, went to California. So there's a variety. So picking a place that's going to help you tackle Arctic questions, but sometimes the best resources aren't always in the Arctic for the kind of questions you need to tackle. And I'll just make a plug for Beth's state of Montana. And I know that myself working there, there's phenomenal world-class research going on with Native American communities that is globally important for the work that's done in Indigenous communities, whether in Canada, Scandinavia, Russia, and so on. So think broad. So I hope to answer both of those questions with this answer.
Thanks. I just to jump in, I know we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we've gotten a lot of questions about eligibility.
Okay.
So I just want to make sure. Yeah, I just want to make sure that we cover a few items.
Thank you.
If we move to the next slide. Just want to point out, these are the eligible countries that are participating in the Fulbright Arctic Initiative. And these are the individuals that you can contact with the contact information for specific information. So, for example, if you're looking for assistance with identifying a particular host institution in Sweden, you could reach out to Eric Johnson, for example. And certainly just to point out, the visiting scholar application, so for our non-U.S. Candidates, the applications are submitted through each of the Fulbright offices that you see here. And for the U.S. scholar applications, those are submitted through the U.S. And you can contact me at arctic@iie.org. I know that we, eligibility. Just a brief overview, since we do have both our U.S. and our non-U.S. Prospective applicants on the call. We are expecting around 16 scholars. Approximately 4 of them will be from the U.S., with at least one scholar from each of the other Arctic Council member states. The program is open to scholars at all career stages and includes applied researchers, professionals, and indigenous experts in both the public and private sectors. Next slide. One criteria to just note about eligibility is that applicants must be citizens of the country from which they are applying and also residing in that country at the time of application. And I think this came up a little bit earlier, but for the research exchange component, the non-U.S. participants will conduct their exchange here in the U.S., and U.S. scholars will go to one of the other eligible Arctic member states. Next slide. So the application for U.S. applicants will close on September 15th, and for non-U.S. applicants, please do reach out to the host country contact for specific application deadlines and guidelines. Next slide. So a brief overview of what to expect after the application closes in September. The notification will be sent in around December of 2020. We'll be conducting a peer review committee after the application closes. And then the Foreign Fulbright Scholarship Board will review the nominated applications with the final selection decisions in December. We're then anticipating the opening group meeting to take place in Canada in the spring of 2021, the mid-year group meeting to take place in Norway in winter 2022. And the individual research exchange can take place anywhere from April of 2021 through August of 2022. And again, remember, it's a maximum of 3 consecutive month visits that can take place at any time during that period, as long as it's completed by August of 2022. And then the final conclusion of the 18-month period is the final group meeting, which will take place in the United States in the fall of 2022. And here you can find our contact information. Our website is cies.org/arctic. Email, you can reach me at arctic@iie.org, and I can also connect you with Greg and Beth. I know a number of you have asked about how to get in contact with them. Please feel free to send me an email at arctic@iie.org and I will connect you with them on our Twitter and Facebook. Let's see, we've gone over a little bit. If we weren't able to address your questions, please do send us an email. And anything else, any final words from our panelists? Thank you so much for joining us and being here today.
No, I just want a huge thank you to Susan and Steve. I mean, as those of you who will participate, you'll quickly learn how invaluable and professional and critical these individuals are I just want to make a note of that because they go as unsung heroes, and my goodness, without them, this kind of programming could not happen. It really is their professionalism and skill level that we have this. So a huge thank you.
Well, thank you to Greg and Beth for their time today. We're really pleased to have two such highly qualified and experienced experts and Arctic researchers leading the next round. And we absolutely love that they're both Fulbright alumni, and that really is going to help them lead the next group with a full understanding of the challenges of what it means to take a diverse, multidisciplinary, international group of scholars and really form a team cohort mentality to look at and take a deep dive into some of the real pressing issues facing the Arctic and keep the focus always on Arctic residents and communities and making policy recommendations that are going to really make a difference. So we're glad that they're with us for round three. And, you know, as everyone has said, we are absolutely happy to answer questions, anything we didn't get to cover today. The email is up there. The website's up there. As are all of our colleagues at the Fulbright Commissions and offices in the participating countries. You saw their emails earlier. I just want to say the recording of this webinar will be posted to the program website, which is right there at the top, cis.org/Arctic. I think, Chanel, maybe you can confirm whether these slides will also be emailed out to folks who were registered to participate today.
Yes, hopefully today or tomorrow I'll be sending out an email to all registrants of the webinar with all of these helpful links, the contact information, the slides, and the link to the recording.
You know, with again, thanks to Greg and Beth and to all of our colleagues from Fulbright offices around the Arctic and to Susan and Chanel for organizing and hosting this today, I will close us out and thank all of our participants for their interest in this program, for all of their good questions today, and we look forward to receiving and reading your amazing applications. It's always so fascinating to see, you know, the diverse and dedicated people who are working on such interesting topics in the Arctic. So thank you, and we will close. Have a great day, everyone.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. See you all later.
Bye.